Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Tuesday, May 14th. I'm Ray Graff. Time once again to talk car maintenance and repair with Gordon Fricke. Gordon is the owner and operator of Barber and Fricke Automotive Incorporated, an independent repair, auto body towing, and used car facility in lovely Hoosick Falls, New York. We welcome your car calls at 800-348-2551. That's 1-800-348-2551. 2551. It's a popular show when Gordo's on, so give us a call now and get in the queue. Or you can email voxpop@wamc.org. He probably wouldn't like it if you called him Gordo, so just call him Gordon. It's voxpop@wamc.org or 800-348-2551. Gordon and your calls coming up. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. On the show today to answer your automotive maintenance and repair questions is Gordon Fricke. Gordon is the owner and operator of Barber and Fricke Automotive in Hoosick Falls, New York. He has been in the auto repair and service industry for more than 30 years. Started out in Germany for his schooling, so he knows quite a bit about German cars and also American cars and Japanese cars and Bulgarian cars. The number to call here is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Yugoslavian cars, remember the Yugo? You can also email us at voxpop@wamc.org if you have a car question, voxpop@wamc.org, or 800-348-2551. Gordon Fricke, welcome back. How are you?
Hi, Ray. Thanks to be back. How are you?
Hey, you know, great to have you here. You're at the shop today, so thanks for carving out an hour here for us.
No problem.
Joking at the beginning about Yugoslavian cars here. You worked on a Yugo or two in your time, yeah?
Believe it or not, there was like one or two in our area back in the day, and everybody I'm still remembers Click and Clack, the Tappet Brothers, right? The original car talk show from Boston, from
vaguely,
Cambridge.
Yes.
vaguely. They said, you go, but the car doesn't.
Buddy of mine, high schoolish, had one. And, you know, it was a little bare bones, but it kept going for a while.
Just basic mode of transportation. They were trying to kind of replicate the Beetle coming across in the 50s.
Yeah.
And I spoke to a Yugo dealer back in the 80s when they were coming in, and that was their model, you know, but it just didn't work.
Yeah, well, that's going to happen from time to time. And you know,
right.
Did you ever work on an Edsel?
No. I've only seen them at car shows. No, I've never had my hands on one. Division of Ford. I mean, it's a Ford product. But,
right. You know, yeah. To me, and I was never in one, I never saw one on the road, but it looked like a pretty cool car.
Yeah, they had a distinct look. That front end, and the talk or the criticism in those days was, and this was primarily from maybe the European community, because my father came over from Germany with Volkswagen,
yep.
And they used to joke about how massive and bulky and oversized American cars were.
Yeah.
And they used to say that the Edsel looks like a Ford squeezing a lemon.
Well, you know, I guess they didn't last long for a number of reasons, but maybe it was the name, too. It was named after one of Henry Ford's kids, yeah?
Yes. Yep, it was.
Gordon Fricke is our guest today, and when you are doing these remote shows, we did them during the pandemic, and from time to time you're too busy and you got to do them on the phone, you send me a text or two and say, well, let's talk about this. Right before we hit the air, you said e-gasoline, and it occurs to me, I don't know what e-gasoline is. So why don't you tell me?
Yeah. Well, so in the mad panic or rush to get everything electrified, there's still a very strong push towards making internal combustion engines carbon neutral.
Okay.
So you can virtually not pollute with them. And behind the scenes, some of the gas companies and car companies have been working on synthetic fuel, synthetic gasoline. And Audi, among a few others, has kind of gotten into the forefront with e-gasoline, or in Germany they call it e-benzin. And It is a synthetic fuel.
Yeah.
It's essentially considered to be carbon neutral.
Huh.
Sulfur-free, benzene-free.
Wow.
But it's expensive. That's the problem. To produce it right now is cost prohibitive because and I don't know what the current cost is. I just thought I'd shoot that at you today just to talk about it. But I think it's, you know, four, five, six times as expensive. So right now, very few people are going to be on board with that. But
well,
if you could get that fuel down too close to where gasoline is, what a great alternative.
Interesting.
Right?
Now, I wonder if you use that, would you need a catalytic converter anymore?
That's a good question, Ray, and I have a feeling you may not.
Because if you didn't, then the savings alone from not having a catalytic converter in your car might make it worth a couple of years worth of the e-gasoline. I've not heard of
it. You know, we've been doing this show a long time. And that was a phenomenal thought that you just came up with. That could you imagine that?
Why do you seem surprised? Is that the first one in all these years?
No. You pop in a lot of stuff, but that's a great side thought. That let's say you could eliminate a ton of the emission controls. That's thousands of dollars.
Yeah, indeed. Well, we got an email, and I don't know how good your memory is. Mine's not all that great. This one comes back from last month. And this is from MJ, came in earlier today. Last time Gordon was on, there was a call about whether or not to replace a Prius that was 10 to 12 years old and had mileage in the 160K plus range. Gordon began answering the question by saying, if you want to keep the car forever, but was interrupted before the sentence ended. I assume that means I interrupted, but I don't know. What is the rest of the sentence? What if we do want to keep a 2012 Prius 300,000 miles forever? That's from MJ.
That is totally not out of the question at all, because let's say the vehicle's in a rust-free environment, not a salt state.
Yeah.
So you're not worried about everything corroding and becoming rusted and unusable. We keep gasoline-powered vehicles sometimes for 10, 15, 20 years with 400,000 miles on them, 100,000 miles on them, and the owners have had to replace major components, engine, transmission, maybe other things.
Yeah.
So let's say the Prius needs a hybrid batteries. Well, even if that's $3,000 or $3,500, it costs you more than that to put an engine in your gasoline-powered car today, and it would cost you more to put most transmissions in. So batteries becoming to the end of their life and replacing them, that's not the worst expense in the world anymore.
Yeah.
I guess the other thing to consider is, what if your hybrid drive fails, your motors, all that stuff? They seem to be very, very long-lasting and durable. I don't hear giant tales of, I kept my Prius or my Tesla or whatever, way past the warranty, and now I'm paying for it because it needs $20,000 worth of repairs, and the car's, had it.
Yeah.
So, yeah, no, there's no reason why that Prius can't keep going.
All
my
right.
Concern would be age and salt and all the deterioration that comes with driving in salt states, snow states that use salt on their roads.
Yeah, and unfortunately we have a lot of that around here.
Yeah.
This email from Chris in Cornwall, and then we'll take a break. 800-348-2551 is the number, and we'll hit the phone soon with Gordon Fricke. Chris in Cornwall writes, I have a 2017 Mini Cooper with 55,000 miles. Took it to the dealer because a mouse had disappeared into it someplace that was inaccessible to me. They said that while searching, they found some crystallization that they said indicated a leaky water pump. I've heard nothing unusual while I'm driving. Should I assume they're correct and replace the water pump, or could I wait for a check engine light? And is there a possibility that the mouse could have chewed through something to cause the leak? And that's from Chris in Cornwall.
Yeah, I know exactly what he's talking about. And there are service bulletins issued by most car manufacturers alerting the service departments to not replace water pumps due to the presence of dried coolant exiting the weep hole of the water pump. The water pump has a little vent, and they call it a weep hole, because inadvertently or by normal operation, a tiny bit of coolant is going to get by that seal.
Yeah.
And they make a place for it to drizzle out. And it shows up as in a Mini Cooper, the coolant is blue. So you're going to see a dried blue, crusty, white material. So the car manufacturers make it clear under warranty, at least, if it's not an active leak, if you can pressurize it and not observe it dripping, if it's just a stain or a dried stain, not to do anything about it.
Huh.
So he's in that territory of cars off warranty. Are they eager to sell the repair, or is it dripping or actively losing coolant? That's what's got to be determined.
And so how would you determine that if you didn't want to bring it in to determine that?
You'd need to go to a different shop.
Okay.
And pressurize the cooling system and observe it for a little bit of time. And if it's zero, if it doesn't push any coolant out, and if it still looks exactly the same, you could say to your customer, currently you don't have a leak. There is evidence that there's coolant at the weep hole. And if it's massive, I mean, if it's like a big crusty mess, you might say, you know, this is definitely going to be a problem.
Yeah.
But somebody's got to get their eyes on it and make a judgment.
All right. Gordon Fricke's our guest. We'll take a quick break here. The number is 800-348-2551. We'll hit the phones in a moment. Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff with you. Gordon Fricke's our guest today from Barber and Fricke in Hoosick Falls, New York. If you have a car question, give us a shout, 800-348-2551. Very quickly before we go back to our phones, Frank in Rhinebeck is going down memory lane. Said the Yugo was a stripped-down Fiat to keep the cost down. They cost only about $5,000.
Yeah, it was a Fiat-based vehicle, but it was definitely made in Yugoslavia. But
yeah.
I think they purchased maybe tooling and equipment from Fiat. Yes, that does ring a bell.
Interesting. All right, let's go to Albany. And Jim, you're on. That's a flush. It's nicely done. You're in the John. Hello, Jim.
Wow.
Okay. Hello.
Hi, Jim. I hope we didn't catch it a bad
time.
Oh,
I'm first.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. No, I'm first. Okay. Thank you.
Yeah.
I have a 2010 Honda Ridgeline with 200,000 miles. The transmission fluid's never been changed, and very rare I do get a little bit of like hesitation or chatter on the transmission, but very rare. And I've already changed the timing belt once, and I guess I'm going to be doing it again if I keep this car. But what about the transmission? What do you suggest I do as far as either changing it or let it go?
Well, that's a good question. Because did you buy this vehicle new?
I did. I bought it brand new.
Yeah. And don't take this question wrong, but why did you never have the transmission fluid serviced all these years?
Well, to be honest with you, I never got notified of the transmission. I got notified of the rear axle. I got notified about the timing belt, but this one slipped by.
Yeah. And I'm not trying to be critical because Honda does it this way, because Hondas use a bit different of an automatic transmission than a lot of vehicles do. And they just have a drain and refill procedure. It's very easy, very simple to do. It's like changing the oil in the engine minus the filter. It is pretty sure it's in all of their, service charts, their maintenance requirements or recommendations. But to answer your question, there is truth to not changing the transmission fluid or at least doing a total flush when you have that many miles on it. Because you could loosen up some debris that could get plugged up in the valve body or in some of the solenoids, and then now you got big trouble you never had. It's not quite such a critical thing with Honda-matics. because you're doing a drain and refill, you're just taking out like 3.5 quarts and you're putting in the same amount, the total capacity is 12 or 13 or something like that. So you're not shocking it or flushing it. Where do you who do you normally take the vehicle to? I don't mean the name of a shop, but is it the dealership or do you have a repair shop that you go to?
No, I usually go to the dealership.
Okay.
Okay. Yeah, I'm just amazed they haven't suggested that transmit. So I would get their opinion on it. Just you know, if you're getting ready to do other maintenance or repairs, just ask them that question. Hey, I don't think the transmission's been changed at all. Should we do a drain and refill, or what do you guys think? Get their opinion on it.
Okay.
Well, what they said, I did ask him, and he said that, we would just drop the pan and change the fluid that's in the pan.
Well, see, it doesn't really have a pan.
He said,
"Would
you?"
Yeah, there's just a drain plug. It's just a drain and refill.
Oh. Okay.
If their experience to drain and refill those at that mileage is positive, I would definitely do it.
Okay. Jim, thanks a lot for the call. Now, again, you and I have talked over the years that sometimes it's almost past the point of no return on these things. You just let it ride.
It is on certain. What we'd call a conventional automatic.
Yeah.
You can have trouble if you never change that fluid at super high mileage and it's very dirty and contaminated, and you do a big flush, you can stir up trouble, and then you've got a transmission problem.
Interesting. All right, let's go to Chatham. Jerry, you're on with Gordon Friggy.
Hi there. So I have a 2015 Jeep Grand Cherokee. Last time I had it serviced, they said the radiator was seeping, which I'd never heard before, and I should keep watch of it. Now, is this something that I could put some stop leak in, and that would be sort of dependable? I mean, they want $1,400 to put a new radiator in, saying the front clip of the car has to come off to do that.
Okay.
So what do I need to know about this to get the best deal and to drive it safely?
So, yes, radiators do seep. And the reason why is the core of the radiator is made out of aluminum, and the tanks on the outside are made of plastic. And they're crimped together, and there's an O-ring seal that seals the tank to the core of the radiator on each side. Usually the location that they'll start to seep, because you've had thousands of hot, cold cycles. So the tank expands differently than the core, and it just, after a while, it just doesn't like it anymore. If it's, are you actively adding coolant to this thing?
No, not really. And, you know, I've been keeping track of the temperature gauge, and it's not going up, and I don't really see any leaks in my driveway, so.
Right. Well, so you're not getting alerts, or you're not adding to it. The reservoir on the outside, you know, is not the true level of the coolant in the engine. But what is the vehicle again? I'm sorry?
Grand Cherokee.
2015 Jeep Grand Cherokee.
Yeah, Grand Cherokee. Okay, I'm just trying to picture the setup on that. Yeah, so to answer your question, there are some very mild sealants that can be put in that are harmless to the cooling system. They won't plug anything up. They won't damage anything. And believe it or not, a very nice product is made by a company called Holtz, H-O-L-T-Z, I think it is. And you buy it at the Subaru dealership.
Wow.
I haven't seen it aftermarket in other, I mean, it's an English company. So it's probably in other people's cans or jugs, but you could stop by any Subaru dealer, and you could pick up a jug of it, and it has to go directly in your radiator, not the plastic overflow tank. So the level of the coolant has to be down enough where it'll accept a bottle of this stuff.
Yeah.
And it's very harmless. I've used it for years because Subaru actually used it as a service bulletin on coolant seepage, and the stuff is marvelous.
All right, Jerry, good luck. Thanks a lot. By the way, speaking of transmissions earlier, Kevin in Greenfield writes in, last month I asked about my 18 Ridgeline that was bucking and hesitating a bit on some accelerations. I had the transmission fluid changed and the problem has been solved. So there you go.
Yeah, well, going back to that previous Ridgeline call, transmission fluid will, quote, wear out. It'll lose its properties, and it'll become sometimes too slippery.
Yeah.
It makes the clutches chatter. And changing it is sometimes feels like a miracle cure. And it's very common in a lot of General Motors vehicles today, a lot of the pickup trucks. GM changed the specs of their transmission fluid because of this condition, and it's night and day. If you drive the truck with the worn-out fluid in it, you're thinking it needs a transmission. You change it to the new stuff, and the problem's gone.
Amazing. Let's go back to our phone lines. Gordon Fricke's our guest today. 800-348-2551 is the number. Chris is in Johnstown. Hello, Chris.
Hello, Ray and Mr. Fricke. Thank you for taking my call.
You bet.
I have a 2008 BMW 750i in great mechanical condition. I'm experiencing a problem with filling the tank up. I have no problem filling it for like 8 gallons or so, but after that, the vapor recovery system shuts off the nozzle, and it takes me forever throttling the fill lever in order to get it full. I've never overfilled it, so I don't think it could be the canister. I don't think there's a plug in the fuel system, but what's your opinion?
Have you ever had a check engine light on?
No.
Because there is a system that allows you to put gasoline in the tank, let the air out, and that vapor laden air goes into the charcoal canister. And there's it's called a canister vent valve. The vent valve opens up, and the vapors go into that charcoal canister to be collected. It is possible that your charcoal canister is getting restricted and it's not letting that air pass quickly enough. Or the canister vent valve is working enough to not alert the computer, but not opening up enough to vent. When you put gas in, that's a lot of air coming out. You know, these pumps push a pretty high volume of gasoline in. So it's definitely EVAP related. I don't know if there's any, you could do an internet search to see if BMW has any service bulletins on that subject, because it's possible that they've had a glitch. Even though the car's, not current model year, there's going to be information on it. I don't know if a dealer could. I think a dealer could do that if they would take the time to look up service bulletins for you or search them on the internet. But I got a feeling it's related to that vapor recovery system. But I don't see too many. Not that the 750 uses any different of a vent system, but it's going to be a problem maybe unique to that car.
Yeah, this car only has 96,000 miles on it, so it seems to me too early for that thing to fail.
Well, it could be part of it. There's the canister has a atmospheric vent, and there was some Chevy pickups for a while that had a problem with the way they routed that vent, and I can't remember if mud got in there or if it was susceptible to bees making a nest in there, but that vent would partially clog up.
Uh-huh.
And it couldn't get all the vapors out fast enough.
Okay.
So that's what I'm thinking is your area of concern.
All right, Chris.
Pardon me?
He said that would be your area of concern. All right, Chris, we're going to have to wrap it up, but you can quickly follow up.
Does this canister need to be inspected when do you need to drop the tank or not?
I don't think so. So this is a V12.
Whoa.
No, V8.
The V8. be it. Okay, because the early ones, we had a customer with an early 750, and it was a V12, which, you know, doesn't matter really in terms of that system. But I don't think it's on top of the gas tank, but I can't be sure of that.
Okay, Chris, thanks a lot. I drove a V12 once. I drove an Jaguar SJS on a Sawmill Parkway. I like having those extra cylinders. It was...
Oh, it's so smooth, isn't it?
Yeah. All right, let's go to Lisa in Stone Ridge. Lisa, you're on with Gordon Fricke.
Hello, how you doing?
Good, how you doing?
What, can you all hear me, or should I shut my radio down?
I think you should shut your radio down, because now we are with you on the phone.
Okay.
Okay.
Great. So here's the problem. I have a 2013 Subaru Legacy, and for the last couple of years, it passes inspection, but my horn doesn't work. And I think the only reason why it passes is because when I start the car up, the horn does work. Oh. But then as you're rolling along, it no longer works. So a friend of mine looked at it, and he didn't think it was the fuse. So where do I go from here to a mechanic that I don't want to? This is not my expertise,
right?
So I need help.
Gordon.
So the horn does work first part of the day?
When she starts the car.
It works as soon as you put... When I start the car, it works. Then minutes into it, it does not.
In other words, you can start the car
in
the morning.
That's why I think... Right.
Yeah, so you can start the car,
and that's why
a bunch
I think it's able to... Right. That's why I think it's able to pass inspection, because they start it right up, and yes, it, you know, it works. But it
then after a while during the day, you don't have a horn working anymore.
That's right.
Okay. It sounds like, so is it temperature related? Does it last longer in the wintertime? I mean, obviously you don't go down the road blowing your horn for an hour, but...
I would hope not. And I'm not that kind of aggressive driver where I'm blowing the horn at people either. No, it doesn't matter the temperature outside.
Yeah, that's a strange condition, because usually when things work for a while when you first start the car, it's usually a temperature thing. So
is it something loose within like the wheel itself?
Well, it could have to do with the actual horn contacts that are in the steering wheel. The downside to that in today's world is there's also an airbag in there, and the horn contact then feeds through the what's called the spiral spring or the clock spring to carry the current through the column to the rest of the car. So we see a lot of spiral spring failures, but they are very seldom intermittent like that. They just usually stop working, or they may work when you spin the wheel at a certain way and then stop because that wire is ready to break off. So,
Can I just ask a couple quick follow-ups here, Gordon, and jump in real quick?
Yeah.
All right, Lisa, when you turn the car on, you press the horn, or does it just go?
I press the horn.
You press it. So that mechanism works.
Right.
Okay. And then...
Yes.
It seems odd to me that it would... Does it do it every time when you turn it on? Can you do it every time? The first time you turn...
Yes.
Wow, that's so weird. All right, back to you, Gordon.
Yeah, so that's why... So when you take it to the shop, it will more than likely be in the failed mode. And at least when it's failed, that's when you can troubleshoot it and try to narrow down the area of where the problem could be. So your shop is going to have to just do horn troubleshooting. And, you know, it's basically like it always was. It's just that clock spring is just a tricky element built into the system that takes more time. And you have to be careful, because now if you go and take that horn pad off, you have an airbag in there. You have to deactivate the system, and you know there's just more time and expense involved in it.
Sure.
But it's still basic.
Oh, I'm sure. The expense part is what I'm nervous about.
Yeah.
right.
Now let me ask you a question, Gordon. If Lisa wanted to say, you know what, to heck with this. I'm going to buy an outboard horn that
like from a boat?
Yeah, you know, some kind of a horn. You put it under the hood and you just have a little button, you press it. Could you pass inspection
funny.
With that?
Oh, it's funny you say that because I have a couple of vehicles out there, and one we fixed. One was for lack of part. We couldn't get a part. This was right after the pandemic. It needed one of these clock springs. But I rigged up what I called a hillbilly horn.
Yeah, buddy.
It, what I did is, on one car, I went out to the backyard
and took
a horn off
notes,
the junk
right?
car.
No, you don't need to take notes. You can listen online later. Don't worry. Go ahead, Gordon.
Yeah.
There's
two methods of doing this. You can wire a push button inside the car to the relay that honks the horn under the hood, providing that circuit's okay. And that's pretty quick and easy. But you've got to live with an external horn button now somewhere near your steering wheel. And that's a hillbilly horn. You're working around the steering column, but you still have a horn that works by pushing a button.
I love it. Hey, Lisa, we got to take a break here, but thank you very much for the call. Gordon Fricke is our guest. You know, you got one of those old big rig trucker horns that you pull down the chain and you honk that thing.
Yeah, I want a railroad horn.
Yeah, now we're getting somewhere, and the show's two-thirds over. Gordon Fricke's our guest. We'll be back. Big J, there's John Schofield on Vox Pop. 800-348-2551 is the number. Ray Graff here. Gordon Fricke's over there. He is doing the show over the phone. And Sam wrote in just now. I'm wondering if anyone has tried that horn in park versus in drive versus in neutral versus in reverse. Would that have anything to do with it, do you think, Gordon?
I don't think so, because her shifter's on the floor. It's a Subaru. He may, you know, if it was a car with a column shifter, yes. My in-laws had a vintage Mercedes-Benz. It was a 65 220.
Yeah.
And the mechanism in the steering column got very sloppy. A bushing wore out where the shifter is. And the shifter, when you put the car into park or from drive to park, it would reach up there and make the horn sound. And this car had unbelievably loud horns. And that was because one of the shifter bushings had worn out. But I don't think it's going to affect this Subaru.
All right. This is from Patrick in North Adams. How often should points be serviced and replaced? Are the electronic conversion kits worthwhile? The vehicle? Oh, yeah. It's a 69 Grand Prix. I put 1,500 to 2,000 miles on it during the warm seasons.
Yeah. You know, I'm in the same category with, I've got some old vehicles with points, but I put so few miles on them that it doesn't really matter. If it's a muscle car, which this kind of is, and you want higher energy ignition, you eliminate the points, you get a more powerful coil and larger gap spark plugs, and you have a high energy ignition system.
Yeah.
If it's just a classic car that you have some fun with for 1,500 miles a year, you can change them. They make drop-in kits, and then you never mess with the points again. And those are not that expensive, and they're pretty easy to do. So it's not a bad idea. There's a company that makes a drop-in kit that eliminates the points at very little work. You're not rewiring and changing a whole bunch of stuff.
Gordon Fricke's our guest today. It's Cars on Vox Pop. We do it every month. 800-348-2551 is the number. Let's go to Hudson and Rick. Rick, you're on.
Oh, good afternoon. I recently acquired from a relative a 2003 Chevy S10 pickup truck. 80,000 miles on it. It was used on the estate, so the truck rarely left the estate to go anywhere or do anything. That's why it's got such low mileage. So I took it to the local GMC dealer to have it inspected and everything, and needed tires. I had a coolant flush, new thermostat, air conditioning needed some work done on it. The emergency brake didn't work. All this done to bring it up so it would pass inspection.
Yeah.
And through all of this, I asked about the timing belt. And I had a Chevy S10 pickup 25 years ago, and I was on the thruway doing 65 miles an hour, and then the belt broke, and it literally put a piston rod right through the hood.
Oh boy!
And so that I've had experiences with a belt breaking. So the technician gets into the computer and looks in. And he says, well, this vehicle doesn't have a belt. It has a timing chain. And the chain is good for the life of the vehicle. My question is, what is the life of the vehicle? And I would assume that a timing chain is a moving part, and don't eventually all moving parts break down?
Eventually they do. That's a correct statement. So does this truck have, so it's an 03.
Yeah.
Is that what you said? 2003. So is it a V6 or a four-cylinder?
It's a V6.
It is. Okay. So that was a pretty good engine. That would be a 4.3 liter, probably a Vortec is what they called them in those days. Those engines suffered very, very few timing chain issues.
Okay.
And you're at 80,000 miles?
Yep.
I don't think I'd be concerned.
That, so when they say it's good for the life of the vehicle, I hear some people have vehicles out there with 200,000 miles on it. The chain would be good for that amount of mileage.
It's possible, as long as the oil was changed correctly and, you know, at proper intervals with good oil. And what's tougher on timing chains is a lot of idling, stop and go, short trips, cold starts, never really fully warming up.
Yeah.
All the things that are bad for any engine. If this is a highway vehicle, commutes or is used as a sales vehicle and gets all those miles put out in a short period of time, yeah, that timing chain can go 200,000 miles. But at 80,000 on yours, I don't think I'd be a bit concerned. And most of the pushrod engines, which is what you have, and I don't know that one exactly. It could be looked up, but most of those did not suffer any damage if that chain were to break or jump a few teeth.
All right, Rick, thanks a lot. You know, I suppose you could say the chain is good for the life of the car, because if the chain goes while you're driving it, the car is pretty much toast. Isn't that true?
Well, that was definitely the case on a lot of timing belt engines and overhead cam chain engines, but you're correct. If that chain or belt went at highway speeds, it usually trashed the engine, and if it's an expensive enough car, you're into a massive repair bill.
All right, let's go to Joan in Schenectady. Joan, you're on with Gordon Fricke. Hello, Joan.
Hello, Ray, and hello, Gordon.
Hello.
I do have a quick question about my 02 Subaru, but first I wanted to join the conversation about small EVs, beginning with, yes, I do remember Yugos. how can I convince Volkswagen to make a Karmann Ghia instead of a Karmann Ghia? Small car, loved the way it drove, put a nice heat engine in there instead of how cold it was.
Right.
Wouldn't that sell?
Well, the thing of it is, with vehicles like that, everybody in the Northeast said, how could they be selling so many of these cars? But not all are sold in cold climates, you know?
I got that, and that it was historically a cold car operating.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
They're just so cute. And I'm like, wow, that wouldn't take a lot of battery power to maneuver that light thing. Anyway,
that's nice, Joan.
Here's my real question.
Okay.
On my 02 Subaru, I've looked through the owner's manual that came with the vehicle. I did get it secondhand. Is there a serviceable air filter anywhere? I've looked.
For the engine or the cabin?
For the engine.
Most definitely, yes. Yep. All internal combustion engines have air filters.
Okay. So I've never, even come across how to change it. I'm going to assume that my mechanic routinely changes that.
Oh, it's, yeah, I would, okay. An O2, I would think if it had never been changed, it would be so plugged that it probably wouldn't run too well. But I shouldn't say that because we'll get a vehicle in here that's 10 years old with whatever, 90,000 miles on it. Mm-hmm. Take the air cleaner housing apart, and it looks like a disaster area in there. And the other day I had one, and it was original markings from the factory, whoever made the car at that time. I can't remember now what it was. But so, yeah, no, if you don't have any record of it being changed, it'd be a good idea to get it checked and change it for sure.
All right.
Okay.
Thanks,
and
Joan.
And since my owner's manual didn't lead me to air filter, air cleaning might lead me there?
It should be in the maintenance section of your manual. It might be a separate little booklet or somewhere else, but yeah, it will call it an air filter, engine air filter. Mm-hmm. And yours is an O2?
O2, yep, an O2.
O2.
GTO wagon, the legacy wagon.
Yeah, and it probably has a cabin air filter as well, which filters the air coming into the heating and air conditioning system, basically to the occupants in the cabin. So if yours has a cabin filter, that definitely wants to be changed because you're breathing the air that goes in that thing.
Okay, Joan, we got to let you go there, and we'll get a couple of more calls in here before we wrap it. 800-348-2551. Quickly, Kay writes in, my four-wheel drive is driving me crazy. I have a 2020 Chevy Silverado 1500 four-wheel drive. When I'm in 4H or 4L, if I turn the wheel fully to the right or left while in motion, the truck has a mild but noticeable slow shutter, for lack of a better word. I've been told that this is normal, but honestly, it feels like I'm ripping the wheels off the truck. Is this in fact normal? And even if so, am I doing damage? Sure feels like it. I cringe whenever I have to cut the wheel hard while in four-wheel drive. And that's from Kay.
So that is a correct statement that when you engage that into anything but auto, you're sending power to both drive shafts and the front and rear wheel speed. All the wheel speeds actually change when you go through a sharp curve.
Yeah.
All the tires are turning at different speeds now. And that's that strain or shudder that you feel. It's even worse in four low because now you're geared way, way down going super slow.
Yeah.
Four high on that vehicle, I didn't think would create that, but I think she said four high also.
Yep, both high and low.
Yeah. So to sum it up quickly, yes, there's truth exactly to the information that she received on the shuttering. If you put it in four-wheel auto, it takes care of itself via the ABS system.
Yeah.
Going back to the fluid concern or questions we've had today, if it has a limited slip rear differential, it's very possible that that fluid is getting tired and the rear differential is giving it a little more trouble on sharp turns than it should if it has a limited slip rear. And you don't know that till you either look it up in the papers you got when you bought it new. If you didn't buy it new, you'd have to call a Chevrolet dealer, and they would run the VIN number and find out how it was equipped. But
okay.
Those are the two things.
All right, let's go to Michael in Saratoga Springs. Michael, you're on with Gordon Fricke.
Afternoon, gentlemen.
Hello.
I've got a 2002 Porsche Boxster that I'm looking at. It's a one-owner Southern car, 42,000 miles, no history of mechanical issues.
Nice.
But I understand that these vehicles have a propensity for the intermediate shaft bearing blowing out, and that's a catastrophic engine failure. Should I replace that as soon as I get the car?
Well, have you looked into the cost of replacing it?
I believe it's probably $2,000 or so, and if you're opening that up, you probably should put a new clutch in it too. So I'm thinking $4,000 or $5,000 I'm gonna spend.
Yeah, $2,000 is very light on that job in today's world. But do you know for sure that it's never been updated in that vehicle? Do you have the history of the car, one owner car? You said right.
Yeah, I do. It hasn't. The car hasn't had any mechanical troubles, but also hasn't had any work done. It's been babied and
Yep. So the IMS bearing was a high failure part, but it didn't fail all the time in all cars. And the noise that it begins to make in the early, early stages is a telltale to get it done. And you'd need a trained ear on that engine to listen to it and say, no, this one is not making that sound. But in your long-term ownership of the car, unless you're going to put very few miles on it, it's probably a good idea to investigate changing that. And there's different ways of doing it. There are, you can put the same exact one in that it came with, and then there are improvements to the design. And that's where the money changes a little bit. But it's engine disassembly. So it's big labor, very specialized work.
Okay.
So you don't do it, you're rolling the dice.
Yes, you are, but they do start to make noises before they don't usually just explode and fail. And because the engine's kind of in the middle of the car and they make weird sounds, you know, they're different sounding engines altogether to begin with, I think a lot of unsuspecting people just kept driving them and they kind of ignored the noise. And they, if you've done any investigating on it, yes, they can blow the engine, and then you're in real big trouble.
Michael, thanks for the call. Gordon, while you were on that call, I came up with a great idea, and I'm giving this to you. You can make the millions on this, all right?
All right.
You know how there are those apps that people have on their phones that can identify birds?
Yeah.
You can get an app. You should get an app that identifies random car sounds. You have to punch in what kind of car you have and the year, and then you put the phone up, and it analyzes it and tells you, oh, yeah, well, you got this bearing going. Oh, it looks like it's your blah, blah, blah. So that's for you. You make that happen, all right?
Very interesting. You know, I have had a lot of people come in with their phones and play back to me noises that their cars were making. The downside is the audio is so poor that sometimes it's really hard to tell what it is. But I've also had people give me pretty good recordings of, you know, let's say they put the phone right near the engine and you hear a distinct clicking sound. You can make out that sound. So it's an interesting concept.
Yes, it is. And it'll be worth millions of dollars. So it's Gordon Fricke's now. Very quickly, let's go to Stan in Saratoga. Got about 30 seconds, Stan.
Hi, guys. I'll make it quick. I've got a 2021 RAV4 plug-in hybrid with lots of bells and whistles. And when you put it on cruise control and you come up on somebody on the highway, it automatically slows you down to keep a certain distance behind that car. My question is, am I being slowed down because my brakes are being engaged or because the transmission's doing something or something else?
A combination. It is actually capable of applying your brakes.
Okay, so
is that a quick enough answer?
I'm gonna break down if I. Yeah, that's enough answer.
All right,
thank you very much.
Go ahead, Gordon.
I drove a few cars years ago that I didn't realize had the adaptive cruise, and this happened to be a BMW, and I had the car engaged. It's actually a car that I had for a while, and I was getting ready to sell it, and I had the cruise set, and all of a sudden something came up, and that car put the brakes on. And this was like an 07 car.
Wow.
I said, I can't believe that this technology is in a car this old. And to answer the question, yes, it relaxes the throttle or the gas pedal, and it applies brakes as needed.
All right, listen, I'm going to apply brakes as needed to this program because Count Basie's playing. Gordon Fricke, spectacular job once again, sir. You know what? It's very unlikely that we will have a show next month because that's smack dab in the middle of the fun drive. Which
right.
So you get a month off most likely, all right? You okay with that?
I got June off.
Yeah,
that's great.
Quite possibly. All right. Hey, Gordon Fricke, we'll talk to you whenever. Thanks.
Thank you.
Support comes from Avila Independent Retirement Community, featuring a maintenance-free lifestyle with gourmet dining, housekeeping, daily activities, and more. Rental options now available. AvilaLiving.com. And the Lake George Land Conservancy, Bolton Landing, New York, providing more than 40 miles of trails for nature therapy and exploration beyond the shore of Lake George. HikeLakeGeorge.org. If you want to hear Gordon Fricke early next month on that Tuesday, you got to fill the lockbox, WAMC.org. We could end the drive now, and then we'll have a show. Meanwhile, tomorrow it's Pets and Vets with Ron Scharf. We'll see you then.